Welcome to the RCP Medicine Podcast, a Training Matters episode. I'm Dr. Rohan Mehra, an RCP Clinical Education Fellow and an Infectious Diseases and Microbiology Registrar. Training Matters is a new concept where we present an insight into an aspect of training you may be curious about but have been unsure where to start. Today, we will be discussing research, an area that many physicians choose to go into. Research has the potential to impact millions, and without which we would most likely still be bloodletting and balancing humours as a profession. So to explore this incredible topic, I have two excellent doctors who can share the insights and tips from their journeys so far in the world of research. Allow me to introduce firstly, Dr. Meryl Henderson. Meryl is a clinical research fellow and specialist trainee in HIV and genitourinary medicine at Imperial College London. She is currently registered as a PhD student exploring biomarkers of neuronal inflammation, immune activation, and injury in people living with HIV. She has an interest in global health and has worked in South Africa prior to undertaking her specialty training. Welcome, Meryl.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And secondly, let me introduce Dr. Josh Elliott. Josh is a specialist trainee in infectious diseases and microbiology and is currently a National Institute for Health and Care Research and British Research Council Clinical Research Fellow in Multiomics School of Public Health. He is investigating pheno and endotypes of post-COVID syndrome and their crossover with multimorbidity. He has a master's in health data analytics and machine learning, and on top of this is an extremely talented actor, comedian and musician who has even performed at Glastonbury. How I wish I had been there. Welcome, Josh.
Wow, well said, Ryan. Thank you for having me as well.
Thank you both for being here. So if you don't mind, I'd like to start by just hearing a little bit about what you're both working on at the moment. So Meryl, do you mind just telling us a little bit about what you're working on?
Yeah, of course. So as you've already alluded to, my research is focused on HIV in the central nervous system. So yeah, assessing for the potential effects of HIV on the brain is obviously really important. For example, in people with HIV who have neurological symptoms, but also in people with HIV in clinical trials to determine the effects of new HIV treatments on the brain, some of which might require them to come off antiretroviral therapy to assess the response to treatment. But our current methods, you know, are either often quite expensive and impractical to undertake, like MRI imaging, or they can be quite invasive in the case of lumbar punctures, which aren't always acceptable to individuals. So it's really important to find new practical ways of monitoring brain health in these people. So my research is mainly focused at looking at new ways to investigate these individuals, and I'm looking at specifically plasma biomarkers of brain health in people with HIV.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, I think, you know, just from my experience of patients that I've worked with living with HIV, the thought and the process of often having to go through, as you say, numerous LPs, numerous investigative procedures, and even now when we get into this later generation, the older population who we're starting to see the side effects of a lot of antiretroviral therapy and the effect it's having on them, and I think that's an incredible area to be working on, and I think we'll all be waiting to see the outcome of that, because it'll be very helpful to everyone working in that field, and you know, it will be a huge difference to those patients.
Thank you. Yeah, I hope so. It's really exciting.
I mean, so no pressure now, Josh. Can you tell us a little bit about your research?
Yeah, it's not going to be as eloquent as that, but essentially I'm working with a large cohort of people who agreed to be tested and followed up, tested for COVID during the last few years in England. And then some of those people will have further detail, further information about them, whether it's genetic or other omics. So that includes metabolomics, etc. And then looking to see if there's some sort of correlation between the patterns of people's omic profile and their disease status or their symptoms, etc. And also looking at symptom phenotypes as well of long COVID or post-COVID syndrome.
Wow, I mean, again, you both do very valuable work. I mean, Josh, I think that's even just today, I think there was quite a large BBC article that went out talking about long COVID and how much is still not understood about it, and concerns both for patients and physicians about misdiagnosis and potential complications that there may be in the future. So I think anything that is done to kind of start to untangle that web, which, you know, is just one of the many things that COVID caused, but to hopefully give people more of an answer into what's going on will be really, really valuable. So I'm going to take you both back a little bit, if that's okay. And I'd just like to ask you, how did you first become involved in research, and what made you want to be, you know, what made you want to get involved in research? And I'll start with you this time, Josh.
I didn't really know about the academic training pathway, certainly during the foundation program. And later on, I felt a bit intimidated by the training program for whatever specialty. At the time, I wasn't sure what specialty I wanted to do anyway. And so that led me into wanting to sort of develop my skills more broadly for research so that I had a bit of a broader wealth of skills I could draw on in the future and allow me to be a bit more selective about what I wanted to do. I also thought I wanted to see if I could get into the data side of things because I thought that would be useful regardless of whether I went into the wet or dry lab research. And yeah, I think it's just exciting, isn't it, to feel like you're contributing to in whatever way, even from an audit level onward, if you're doing analysis properly, it's contributing to the latest understanding of whatever your field is. And that's what led me to take a little break before I went into internal medicine training. I did my master's at Imperial, which was in, as you said, it was in sort of very data science-y master's. And it gave me a flavour for whether I could do it, which I thought I could. And yeah, just took it from there.
Amazing. So I think you really saw the kind of gap. It's interesting what you say about not being aware or perhaps even being slightly intimidated by that kind of formal route in foundation when it's apparent. And that if firstly you are aware that a training pathway exists, I think for a lot of people it is, as you say, it is that there is this intimidation surrounding it. There is this kind of uncertainty about that as your pathway into research. And it's really interesting the point you make about wanting to be at kind of the forefront as well of things that are happening in your field. And I think it's really important to realise we all think of research and think of these massive discoveries which affect hundreds of thousands, millions of people straight away. But recently, Professor Chris Whittier, recently did a talk at the college, and he was saying that actually one of the things that you see is it's the very incremental gains that you get from kind of one study here, one study there, one study there. You know, everyone would like to think it's this one drug that was developed that changed the world, but it's often not that. It's these tiny little steps that everyone makes that all the research contributes to that end up really changing the picture of public health. Meryl, what are your thoughts about that? And you know, what about you? You know, how did you first become involved in research?
I think probably a series of fortunate events, really. So I think prior to starting an ACF in HIV gum, to be honest, I hadn't had a lot of research experience. You know, certainly when I was at medical school, I hadn't had a lot of exposure to research. And after my foundation training, I went to work in South Africa in a rural public hospital. And I think working in an under-resourced setting, it was, you know, hugely rewarding, but also very challenging. And I think that's when I started thinking a bit more about the bigger picture and thinking just how transformational research can be. You know, I know we were just talking about how you can do that in small ways, but I think working in that setting, you know, it was more thinking about the bigger picture for me. The HIV field, I think one of those massive studies was the START study, which was one of the first large scale studies that showed starting antiretroviral therapy straight away can have massive health benefits for people living with HIV, regardless of your immune status. And that's been implemented in guidelines kind of globally now, and everyone starts treatment straight away. And so I think when you see how doing research can have such massive impacts, that's really what made me think, okay, yeah, I'd really like to start doing something like this. And then when I came back from working in South Africa, I was working in a DGH just outside London, and I started just trying to get involved in little projects there, like Josh said, doing audits, quips, things like that. And I became aware of the ACF program, spoke to the program lead for HIV gum, started speaking to different trainees and ACFs, and applied to the program and got in, fortunately for me. But then actually I ended up, while I was in my ACF, going into a clinical research fellow post at Imperial. And that was really the gateway into my PhD. So a slightly different route, but it's been, yeah, been great for me.
And I think it's interesting how you both have picked up on the ACF. And I think, you know, when we think of research, the ACF is definitely what stands out as the most common way that trainees will be involved in research, or the most common pathway for a trainee to get involved in research. And I think now that, you know, as we've started speaking about, it's probably a good thing to talk about now. And I think when we talk about research, we always think of those formal routes, don't we? And we think of you have to go down this one pathway. And certainly when I first heard about the ACF program, I almost thought that was the only way you could be involved in research. I thought if you weren't on the ACF program, there was no way you were going to be involved in any kind of research. But as you pointed out, Meryl, there's, you know, there's value in the research you can do in your local hospitals, in quips, in audits, and the smaller scale stuff as well. You know, what are the kind of less formal ways in? And as you spoke about how now you've switched to being a clinical fellow in research, and that's how you got your PhD funding. Are you able to tell us a little bit more about that as a route into research, as opposed to necessarily that classical ACF pathway?
Yeah, absolutely. Something that I think, first off, there are a lot more non-formal opportunities into research than you think. And I think it's really important to try and get an idea of the landscape in your hospital, in your trust, because it will be different in every trust. But for me, I'm at Imperial, and we have very strong HIV research at Imperial. And two of the, you know, academic consultants had experience of taking registrars on as clinical research fellows, and kind of consequently, you know, allowing that time to explore your research ideas, build up funding applications, and then move on to going into a PhD. And so for me, it's provided me a really beneficial time to actually get more experience of research, feel fully settled that I knew I definitely wanted to do it before embarking on a PhD, because it's a huge undertaking for sure. And I think having some experience is, you know, a really positive thing. And yeah, I would just say it's just so important to try and to speak to different people and get their perspectives, because everyone will have different experiences, and it's definitely worthwhile.
I think that's a really good point. I think one of the things that I was going to say in of my small, you know, involvements in research that I've had in my career, which is, you know, been a little bit of recruitment for trials, a little bit of you know, quip and audit work, no, you know, big projects. But I think it's about talking to people. It's like so many things in medicine. It all comes down to just having conversations with people. And I think until you start having these conversations, you don't actually realize how many people are out there doing this. I think you imagine in your head that it's this kind of really closed off world. There's no one doing it. You know, who do I even approach? Who do I even talk to? But I found that actually, if you just, you know, if you just put yourself out there and you contact people, you know, even if they're not at your hospital, you either reach out and send them an email, or if you're lucky enough, they are in your hospital, just go up and have a conversation with them. Actually, you'll find that this world kind of opens up a lot more and a lot more easily than we think. And I think that's something that I've personally found throughout my career. But it was interesting to hear, you know, instantly you allude to that as well, as you just kind of started having conversations and things fell into place. And I think it is something that I would encourage anyone who, and this is not just for research, but in any aspect of medicine, you know, if there's something that you're really interested in, I think you just have to start having conversations with people. And suddenly you'll find that there are all of these people who have got all of these things going on, and most people are willing to help and want to help.
I think it's also important to highlight, because I think research can seem really daunting from the outside, kind of can feel like it's a difficult circle to get into if you're not already in it. And it can also be really challenging doing research alongside clinical work. And where do you find the time to do it? And how do you fit everything in and progress in your career as you want to? And I think it's a very fortunate position to be in, to be able to take an OOP and go into a clinical research fellow post, which allows you that kind of unadulterated time to dedicate to research. So I don't want anyone to think, by any stretch of the imagination, that, you know, you're a superhuman person that gets all this stuff done alongside progressing in their career. Of course, it's, you make decisions. And I think for me, taking some time to do research has been hugely beneficial. And it's just about getting that experience and then deciding if you want to progress with it.
And Josh, you spoke about your year out doing your master's. Again, it sounds like that gave you the similar perspective. If you had that year to take that time, do your master's, you know, get heavily involved in the data side of things, but it cemented for you that interest in research and that want to pursue it.
Yeah, I actually took 2 years out. I took some, I think I took some time out before the master's to see if I could basically code and whether I had an appetite for it or whether I found it awful. And I think reiterating what you guys have been saying, I'm speaking for people that I know that are either doing PhDs or have done PhDs, postdocs. I mean, I think I got lucky, but for other people I know, you need to, it's like it's a relationship between you and someone who would be supervising you. And, it, you know, just because you might not be a good match with the first person that you start working with or trying to work with doesn't mean that there isn't someone that's not, you know, correctly suited for you. And especially when you're choosing PhDs, but it also applies to, you know, masters or even bachelors, finding a passionate PI who wants you to be there and needs your help. You know, there is funding out there if people want to be taking years out, and, you know, financial thing side of things makes it tricky, that they exist. You just have to cold email people. You know, if you think you know what you want to do, that's at least a focus. But try, be encouraged to try as much things as possible until you find something you think might suit you, and then, you know, have the confidence to pursue it. So for me, I was doing other things other than research. I was doing some of the acting stuff actually that you mentioned, Rohan. And then alongside that, doing a bit of this sort of part-time research position, which led into the master's with the same team. So it's been like I've sort of had loyalty to my team, but that doesn't mean that, yeah, I just want to reiterate that people shouldn't be put off if the first person they go to either doesn't have space for them. I mean, ask them if they could recommend someone else if they don't have space for you in their lab. But yeah, that gave me a flavour. And actually, before I did that, I did integrated BSc for my medical degree, and that was also gave me a flavour. I mean, I had a very dynamic PI, but he didn't have much time to directly supervise me. So that was certainly an interesting experience. And I think you do have to be hard-nosed and dogged and focused to sort of pursue, not that I have all these things all the time, but to get your foot in the door, you have to have self-belief and don't be put off by upsets.
Yeah, and I think it's something that we're bad at in medicine, actually. I think, bad as this sounds, we're often a high-achieving group, and we expect that if you do the right things, you get the right grades, these opportunities will be there. And actually, when you hear no and things don't go your way, or, you know, you fail exams for the first time, you know, all of those things are quite hard to deal with, I think, in medicine. And actually, if you compare it to a lot of people, if you look at careers outside of medicine, there is a lot of work that goes into finding the right people to speak to and contacting the right people. And as you say, Josh, you know, cold emailing people, you may not get a response, but it just takes one to get back to you and be interested. And I think there does need to be a slight change in our mentality. And it sounds like, I think the more people I speak to in research have more of this mentality where you do, just as you say, have to be a bit more hard-nosed and really just stick with it and pursue it. And as you alluded to, Meryl, serendipity will hopefully kick in and lead you on the way. I think, as we've spoken a little bit there about the non-formal routes, I'll probably just take a second to highlight, you know, so we know the kind of formal routes that are out there for anyone listening, so that they're aware of what the kind of classical things are. So as Josh spoke about, we have integrating at medical school, which is where you take a year and it can be to do lots of different things and different degrees, and you'll come out with a separate degree as well as your medical degree. So, for example, at my university, psychology was a big one that you could do for a year, and you could do an integrated degree in psychology. Then I guess your next real opportunity is when you come to foundation training, and there's the specialised foundation programme now, which I think was called the Academic Foundation Programme when we were training, but is now known as a specialised foundation programme. And it's slightly different, actually. It's quite interesting because they have arms, not just in research, but in management and leadership, and also in education. So if any of those fields appeal to you when you're applying for your foundation training, you can actually go down any one of those pathways. So for anyone interested, they should look up the specialised foundation programme. And then, as you both spoke about, you have your academic clinical fellowship, so your ACF. That usually comes about when you apply for specialty training, and you get a post where you have a certain amount of time, which is devoted to research, and you have that time actually allocated within your training. And something else that I found out about recently called flexible portfolio training, which is when you're a specialist registrar, and again, you can have 20% of your training can be devoted towards, very like the specialised foundation programme, one of three streams. So, you know, it may be management and leadership, it might be education, or it might also be research. So I think those are the most kind of formal ways that you can get involved in research. It's probably important to say that there's no right way, is there? I think, you know, Josh, you've probably been on a slightly more traditional pathway with the ACF route. But Meryl, you know, yours, as you say, has been different, and you've found that other way. And I don't think there is a better way. And I think, would it be fair to say that if you're finding one way doesn't work for you, or you're finding one way particularly hard, is it good to try another way?
I think, you know, going into research, everyone probably has their own personal goals in mind of what they want. And I think if you kind of know what you want coming out of it, you'll find a way to make it work. And I think genuinely that's where having a good relationship with your supervisors and really strong supervision makes a huge difference. I've been so fortunate to have really supportive supervisors who have really encouraged me to achieve my goals. And, you know, for me, that was registering for a PhD and having a career in clinical academia. So I think if at first you don't succeed, there will be other ways, and don't lose heart, because I think a big part of research, and I'm realizing this more and more, you know, you send out grant applications, you put things into conferences or journals, and of course you get rejected. That's a natural part of research, and I think getting used to that is important. But if you know what kind of overall outcome you want, then it's just a part of the process.
Some of my biggest successes have come after multiple rejections as well. You know, you just dare to dream big after multiple rejections, and then, you know, sometimes you're lucky. A lot of it is luck, honestly, yeah. But obviously you make your own luck if you keep trying. And what you're saying, Rowan, about other means in, I think this is what I was trying to say, basically, is if you do one thing and it doesn't quite suit you, that is still a useful experience to sell to, you know, an interview. I think if you appear like an interesting person that's done things, obviously any form of publication is useful fodder, and no one can really say, you know, can turn you down completely if you've got something to show. I highly recommend people not to rush and just to take time to explore, to do bits and bobs, and then you can say, look at all the things I've done.
Yeah, I totally second that.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you both, you know, what should people ask themselves before thinking about research? I think one thing that is really clear is actually you would both say get some experience, because, you know, you both did that, but also it sounds like something that you should just do before you're going to commit to this pathway. And as you say, it is a big commitment. Should go out there and get some experience in kind of whatever way it is. Is there anything else that you would recommend people should think about, particularly before they start?
I think experience comes into this, but is it a good fit for you? You know, is it going to fulfill you? Will it make you happy? I think that should be one of the biggest things to ask yourself. For me, when I started, for example, I actually found it pretty challenging at the start, going from maybe working in a ward setting with other people in a team to kind of being much more autonomous and self-directed. And actually, I think in time, I find that really empowering, and it's given me a whole new set of skills that I just didn't have before. But, you know, it definitely did take a bit of time to get used to. So I think it's worth being aware of those differences. And again, getting some experience allows you to make those decisions.
There's different types of existential dread that comes with academia at times. I think these things feel overwhelming, especially if you don't really have a strong idea of what it is, talking about grant applications, whether that be for PhD or whatever. And ultimately, you need someone in your corner who will give you a lot of support. Otherwise, these things just aren't achievable. You need an established lab to support you with a bit of a flavor of what it is you should be doing, so that you could then take the ball and run with it. You know, these things don't come from nothing. But I think you have to sort of make your own dopamine rewards when you're self-directed doing academia. And it is a change from the ward, where you sort of have small problems that you process and it's job done. And it's like, you know, you can end the day and feel like you've done something, and possibly switch off. Whereas with academia, often it's a sort of more ether that you just sort of wade through. But it is, I agree, it is, I really enjoy it. Because there's an opportunity to be creative in research. And I feel like often it doesn't feel like that. Or it feels like you can't really change much from within sort of ward setting, or it's difficult. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have dedicated time set aside for you to do research, it's empowering. But definitely, without actually living it, I think it's hard to imagine what it would be like. Hence, as we were saying, to give it a go and see how you get on with it.
So I'm going to make it really difficult now, and I'm going to ask you to try and give people a taste of what it's like to live that experience. Josh, can you talk us through what might an average week for you look like? Because I think, as you say, it's really different, isn't it, from your day-to-day being a doctor on the wards. It's completely different. So, you know, what does a week look like?
Well, I will preface this by saying that your day will depend largely upon whether you're doing like a wet lab project or a dry lab project. So someone that has to go in every day or most days to look after their cell culture, that is, I suppose, maybe an equivalent to having a 9-to-5, saying, okay, that's my day. And then you analyze your data in the last year. And that has different risks that come with it, because it can feel like if your experiments don't work, you feel like, oh, what am I doing? What's the point of this? Although obviously negative results are important. For me, I'm doing a dry lab project, so it's a lot more of the existential dread that I'm talking about, where, well, I'm still sort of, there's a lot of painful admin that comes with it, a lot of like waiting for things to be accessible, et cetera, et cetera. And then a lot of it is writing skills. So reformatting things for publication, analysis, getting back into analysis, having been doing clinical in the meantime, which can be painful as well, but it's just like relearning a language that you spoke when you were a child. And you really, I'm at the beginning of working as a clinical research fellow, but I'm at the beginning of having to get back into making those small achievable goals that you can say, okay, this is one component of this very large thing. I just need to do this bit. And I think that's the biggest thing, is just making them achievable, but also like the next step. That's a real skill, is trying to analyze a big project and saying this is the next important, most important step.
And Meryl, what's your week look like? Is it very similar? Is it lots of existential dread?
Yeah, every day. No, I definitely second a lot of what Josh has said. I mean, I think one really nice thing about research is every week is totally different, and you can have super glamorous weeks where you're going to conferences and, you know, visiting new places. And then there's obviously the less glamorous bits on a kind of weekly basis. You know, for me, I'm kind of part clinical, part lab based. So for instance, like 2 days a week, I'll recruit clinical trials, and then I might have to process samples in the lab and run downstream experiment. But I also get involved in student teaching, supervise BSc students. There's always a lot of meetings to attend. I'm part of a lab group, so there's journal clubs, a lot of educational meetings. And then I think naturally, as part of a PhD, you do a lot of reading. And as Josh says, a lot of writing, whether that's analysing results, trying to get publications, put in grant applications. So yeah, I mean, for me, my next step is I'm awaiting the transfer of some stored blood samples from a clinical trial. That's kind of the next big part of my PhD. As Josh has already said, you know, I've been waiting a long time for kind of contracts to be put in place and samples to be transferred. So sometimes it can be a bit of a waiting game, and learning to get used to that kind of uncertainty and getting on with things in the meantime and being able to be adaptable and work on different things and change your headspace every so often, just to try and be the most productive you can be with the time you have, I think.
I think you also, I should have said, I'm basically become a little like project manager for myself, but also people that I need to organise things with. A lot of it is project management, just getting things in place. And yeah, as you say, Meryl, swiveling, pivoting between different things. Like, I've just had a paper rejected, so I now need to reformat it and re-edit it, make it appear more glamorous.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because you both highlight such different aspects, which again, I think shows you there is no one week in research. There is no one thing that everyone's time is going to look like. I think that's probably one of the things that's great about research, is that everyone can find something that's going to suit them to a degree, you know, as long as research is definitely what they want to do. But it's a very kind of, it's a very broad church, in the sense of there's, you know, there's lots of possible things that you can do and lots of ways that your week is going to look like, whether that is still with a bit of clinical, whether that is entirely research, and how that blends together. And I think as well, it probably does teach you those other skills, like you allude to, Josh, you know, when you talk about project management and having to deal with that side of things, things that are going to help you in your future, certainly within whatever role you end up doing, because they're skills that you are going to need when you start getting towards, you know, the end of your careers. But actually, they're things that aren't always covered in our formalized training. So actually doing something that gives you that training and gives you that teaching and hands-on experience is really, really invaluable. So is there anything that you know, either of you would say, or I know we spoke, you got a cold email, you got to talk to people, but you know, any tips or anything else that you would say to people who want to get involved in research? What should they be doing? Where should they be looking?
I think you can look locally at your trust, and then obviously a bit more formally looking at, you know, some of the big places like an IHR. But I find locally, you know, there are a lot of people who are really keen. They might have set up young researchers groups, etc., which actually do post a lot of really interesting project ideas, people to collaborate with. And I think that can be a good way to get into something when you're quite early in your career and you don't have much experience.
I think, as I was saying before, from my experience, is I wanted to do something. I mean, I was doing data-related stuff, but I wanted to just upskill in as broad a way as possible so that I could then focus in one avenue. And if people know what specialty they want to go into, that might make things easier, but I didn't for a long time. And I think don't be put off by that. Just, as I was saying before, just if you're interested in something, pursue it. If you have time, there's like a lot of free resources if you want to do coding type things. There's a lot of free online resources, but obviously it's hard to carve out if you're on an on-call rota, which is why I highly recommend, again, taking time out if you can, wherever it might be. Obviously, if you can manage to get things like Quips published somewhere, that's very useful. It gives you a flavour of what it's going to be like, you know, presenting at conferences, etc.
And I think that's got to be the first step, isn't it? I think it's start local. I think, you know, get involved in those projects that are easy for you to get your foot in the door with. You know, start with that local Quip, that local audit. As you say, Josh, that may give you then, if you present it in the right way, give you the experience to present at a conference as well, which is always going to be beneficial for research. And I tend to find in, you know, even the smallest DGHs that I've worked in, there are always people who are quite heavily involved in research. I've never worked at any hospital where there is no one involved in research. And I think people would be amazed that everyone else in the hospital knows who that person is. So you may turn up as the F1 working there, having no idea who that person is. But if you speak to people around you, they will point you in their direction. And I think you guys have hit the nail on the head. It's about starting local, speaking to people and going from there. So I think that's why it's really important to talk to your local team, talk to people in your hospital, because there will always be things like quips and audits that you can get involved in. But not only that, there will often be papers that people will be writing or want help with, and that can be a really good first step into academic writing and starting to understand the academic process. I think, Josh, you make the good point of there are these, you know, there are lots of free resources out there. They are hard, you know, it's hard to carve out lots of time when you're busy doing other things. One that I will just mention is the NIHR and the RCP created 4 free online modules, which any one of you register for free on the NIHR, you can access these modules, and they give you a really kind of broad overview of how NHS research is conducted, how trials are set up, and kind of the interactions with the population and the impact on public health. So I would encourage people to look at those. The RCP are incredibly focused on research, and it's a large priority for the college. And in 2020, published the RCP Research Strategy, which discusses our stance on delivering research for all. And for anyone interested, I would highly recommend that you take a look, as it looks at how the RCP aims to develop and support the workforce to become research active and innovative, to deliver a system that enables physicians to do research as part of improving care, and also to drive new collaborative ways for physicians to accelerate research for patient and public benefit. I think something that I was told right from the beginning and ended up being beneficial later in my career, even though I didn't realise, was, you know, make sure you've done your NIHR Good Clinical Practice course, so that if nothing else, if a trial does appear in your trust, you can go and be a recruiter on it. You know, it's a very basic step, but again, it's something that's very easy for anyone to do. And for people, I think, who've got a bit more time and looking for a bit more of a formalised programme, the other thing I would probably recommend that people look at is the NIHR and the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges recently set up a master's programme. So it's only in its first year, and the PG Cert's in its second year this year, but where they give you hands-on experience in research. And the aim is that it's designed for anyone who'd want to be a principal or co-investigator. And your programme is split into some kind of online teaching modules, but then also some research practical experiences, which are essentially research placements within your specialist's area of interest. And they pair you up with people and they put you into these already set up research projects. So I think, as we've spoken about, people are always worried about, well, who am I going to meet? How do I find these people? I think if people have the opportunity to and are thinking about doing a master's or a PG cert, it's something I would encourage them to look at, because it will help cross some of those bridges that can be really hard, I think, when you're first trying to find your feet in a world that, you know, can be completely alien. Any parting thoughts from either Josh or Merrill that you just want to share before we sign off?
Don't be intimidated, because it's intimidating for everyone. And it's only by perseverance that you'll get to the place you want to be anyway. And it can be by lots of little footsteps that you know make a giant leap. Oh my goodness, put that down in a book. But yeah, no, I think it's just, obviously, if you know people that have done it, it feels more achievable. But I just want to remind people that it is achievable. If you put your mind to it, it is achievable.
I definitely agree with that. And don't be scared to approach people either, because I think generally people in research, they love teaching, and they want other people to love research as much as them. So I think, yeah, just don't be scared to get yourself out there. And obviously, I'm sure both Josh and I are more than happy if anyone wants to get in touch with us and ask more questions.
That's amazing. I think, you know, the key takeaway messages we have to tell people are just talk to people. And the worst thing you will ever be told is no, or maybe completely ignored. But either way, it's not the end, and you can find someone. So reach out, talk to people around you, and reach out to Josh or Merrill as well. And I'm sure they will also be happy to chat and guide anyone who's interested in research. So I just want to say thank you to Josh for joining us. Thank you to Merrill for joining us. And this has been the RCP Medicine Podcast. Please leave us your feedback on the submission form, on anything else you'd like to hear in Training Matters. Thanks for listening.